Is it pylon or pylon? Pylon.
It's actually pylon. It doesn't matter.
Pylon?
Pylon. Pylon's fine.
Pylon's fine, yeah. Okay, this is Inkstead CITR 101.9 FM. I'm sitting in a hallway. This is my most unique interview environment. I kind of like it. It's cozy. It's, you know, not sitting at a desk or a table. And,
exactly.
And in the hallway of Mr. Mark Pylon.
Robert.
And Mark is one of Vancouver's... you get lumped in to a certain genre, but I don't think it's apropos.
Well, you know,
the lowbrow vein.
Well, when you paint sort of graphic arts, graphic design, pop art, you can get lumped into a few genres because it does spin off into a few different categories. I've never really considered myself lowbrow, but I mean, my work goes hand in hand with lowbrow or pop art or.
And I know we've had discussions in the past of, I guess, similar disgust with the. Or maybe I'm just disgusted with the whole concept of lumping everything into lowbrow.
Well, I think it's, you know, it's always been a West Coast phenomenon. And even when I was showing in L.A., I mean, the name lowbrow is a common name. And I think a lot of, I mean, I think these days it's been kind of spun off into a different category, which is now pop art or pop art surrealism. I don't know. I mean, I think Robert Williams kind of coined the word, and a lot of people just kind of fit themselves in that category. And I'm fine with that, but I don't consider myself lowbrow.
Well, you're anything but Robert Williams.
No, I'm not. Well, you know, there is one hot rod in this show, so I guess I could be. You know, I was a Robert Williams fan in the 80s. I think a lot of us cut our teeth on that stuff. I mean, I can't say that.
I was reading Heavy Metal magazine, and
I was inspired by a lot of interesting sort of, I guess you could call lowbrow art in the 80s. I mean, I was just as much influenced by it as anybody else, any other pop artist in town.
Now, let's talk about the your main thing right now is the show you're working on, which is going to be showing in Chicago on February 6th.
February 6th. The gallery is called Rota Fuji, which is actually one of the bigger toy stores in Chicago. It's a really interesting place. It's kind of a vortex of Japanese toyness. It's an amazing place. And originally the show was planned to be shown in Vancouver. And I tossed around the idea of doing a large-scale show of little sort of iconic toy-like blocks. And my original concept didn't work. I tried to cast these things in resin, and it didn't quite work out. It was a bad experiment gone wrong. And one of the galleries I was showing at in Chicago, called DVA Gallery, they picked up the idea. They liked the idea of showing the show, and... And so David Van Alphen, the curator, he He put this show together for me for last fall. Unfortunately, his gallery closed, so he's now curating the Rota Fuji Gallery, which is where the show's been moved for this February. And I have to say, it's been the most challenging show I've done to date, only because it's just such a mixed show. There's just so many ideas and so many different... just trying to pump so many new images and old images, and in a lot of ways I'm trying to exercise my art demons. I'm trying to get rid of the bad and bring in the new, and in the end, when I'm standing in the gallery and I see it all around me, I'll decide where are the artworks going from this point on.
Well, let's talk about why this is such, I guess, a challenge, an exercise, and I almost want to say humility in taking on a large task.
You know, I can't recommend to anyone to actually paint 100 paintings. It's extremely difficult. I thought I could whip off the show overnight. I mean, I really thought I could just paint it and walk away. And I'm now looking at almost five months of solid drawing and painting and prepping. And... really, it's been an ordeal. And, there hasn't been a lot of sleep, that's for sure. I mean, I think the worst part was the drawing. I mean, I draw in the computer first. All these shows start off as a concept. And then I pull it together, all the imagery, and then I spit out the imagery, I print it out, and then I redraw and repaint. And it's so time-consuming, and though I kept the images really simple, the whole idea was to keep everything really simple. I find that even the simplest paintings are taking about 3 hours each. So you're looking at about, 300 hours.
And I was saying, 3 hours looking at the detail, it's still pretty good.
I'm pretty meticulous. I really like tight imagery. I used to paint exactly the opposite. I used to be really loose. I never used any sort of tape. Painted with big black blobby outlines, and I slowly moved to this tighter style, I think in the sort of late 90s, and just to kind of challenge myself, because I got stuck in a rut for a while where I was just painting the same images over and over again. In a lot of ways, this show has kind of gone that way again. I find that I'm painting the same people over and over again, and like I said, in order to kind of force myself to move on from this, I thought I would just expel it all and start fresh after all this is done and decide where I'm going next. It's kind of interesting, actually. I'm kind of excited to see where it's going to go next.
Well, the show is kind of a balance between, I guess, clean, kind of exaggerated figures to straight-out abstraction.
Iconic images. I really like I like single figures. I mean, I can make these pieces really complicated, but I'm really attracted to keeping things simple and clean and design-like. I think being a designer kind of works its way into my paintings, where everything is about control.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about controlling the canvas, and I think maybe in a lot of ways that's probably what's been bugging me a lot lately. Is that I've taken it too far. And there's no fun left in the process. I look at I love drawing, but when it comes to painting, it's become a real ordeal, because my standards have become so high that I go in with the microscope when I start to touch up these things. And it's more of a medical procedure than it is a creative procedure at this point. And it's...
So you don't really have any kind of sketchbook process at all?
I do. My sketches are really... I walk around with my moleskin, and I take it everywhere I go.
Moleskin?
Yeah, and I'm a lucid dreamer, which is amazing. It actually helps my work so much. I pick a lot of my imagery, like this piece here, actually, the Sparkle Dreamer, right out of a dream.
An odd, almost, I want to say... Dr. Seussian.
It's a recurring image. It's come to me in a few different forms. I have very bulbous red creatures.
Oh, wow.
That have always followed me around in my dreams. And and so anyway, for the longest time, I was trying to work them into my art. And
it's this weird, monstrous, red, one-eyed beast?
One-eyed creature. And that's where the whole premise of the name Cycloptic came out of, the fact that I was dreaming about these one-eyed creatures.
And is that the name of the show?
And they were like fun-loving creatures. They would come up to me in my dreams, and I could be laying in bed, and these creatures would be staring at me in the window and illuminating the room and filling the room full of like warm, fuzzy energy. I can't explain it. A lot of these images are straight out of my dreams. It's mostly the abstracts, because
that's really interesting, because most people, when they do dream stuff, it's kind of like they're more like they're exercising, mm-hmm. like nightmares. Like you look at like someone like Jim Woodring, where it's obviously like there's been some like really visceral dreams, and like it's like unleashing that. But for you, it's like a euphoric, calm.
You know,
presence.
It's gone both ways. There was a piece I did a while back called "My Personal Hell." It was a big 6-foot canvas, and it was funny because I think it was in '96 or '97 I was showing at Moonbase Gallery, which used to be the gallery that my wife and I ran in Gastown. And it was the first piece to sell in the show. I mean, the show was full of happy pop imagery, and the first piece to sell was this horrific scene with this priest sitting on a bed holding his head, and these red shovels hovering over his body. And it's funny because I went to a wedding recently and I ran into the guy who bought the piece, and he still loves the piece. I can never understand why anybody would want to hang this nightmare. It was a nightmare in their house. Anyway, you can't explain what people are attracted to. But me personally, I mean, I always lean towards the more happy, colorful, poppy. I mean, it just comes out of me. I don't know why. I don't think it really reflects my personality. It's just somehow Vancouver pulls that out of me. It's been like that since the day I came here.
That's weird, because most people are miserable in Vancouver.
Well,
what's wrong with you?
I don't know.
Why aren't you moving to Toronto?
Well, you know, there's been talk. We're here for now.
I think everyone's moved to Toronto, so.
It's true. And in fact, I talked about that recently in a Georgia Strait article about how quite a few of my friends have abandoned the city. A few of my artist friends, like Jason McLean and Mark Bell, lived here for a little while. And
Mark Bell was always nomadic, though.
Yeah, it's true. But Jason was a big loss, because, you know, he was, for the longest time, you know, he was, especially in our neighborhood in Strathcona, he was Mr. Strathcona, you know. There was a few people actually thought McLean Park was named after him. And, yeah, I kind
of... The King of Strathcona.
it's so true. And, I really miss, you know, and Ryan Heschke, who is also a really good friend, he's recently moved to Los Angeles.
Oh, really? I did not know that.
I mean, maybe I kind of caught that vibe, you know, that I must leave to succeed. You know, I kind of got that fever for a while. I think we've changed our mind. I think we're going to be here for a little while anyway. But
do you think you would be painting the same thing in a different setting? Do you think that Vancouver aesthetic would leave you?
I couldn't say that right now, because, like I said, I'm in a transition right now. I really don't know what my next move is going to be. And like every environment will always change your art. Before Vancouver, I lived in Winnipeg, and back then, I mean, I was painting nothing but black and white. I would not paint color whatsoever. The day I landed in Vancouver, I was painting nothing but color. It was so strange.
That's odd, but I can kind of see that with Winnipeg.
Yeah, I guess.
Because Winnipeg's a pretty dark hole.
Maybe a brick and mortar place. But you know what, Winnipeg is a really creative city. I have to say that it was probably one of the most fun places I've ever lived in.
Well, it's because you have 6 months of winter, so
yeah,
you have to be creative.
It's a very creative place. I mean, it's just so full of artists and just a lot of creative energy. I think a lot of people underestimate the power of that city. I mean, there's still inklings of wanting to go back there and experience that again, simply because I find that Vancouver is very it's very outdoors. It kind of pulls you away from the work. Mm-hmm. Even though it rains, you know, 9 months out of the year, I still find myself, you know, outdoors more than indoors trying to get some work done.
Just throwing the rain.
Well, you know, I'm used to it.
I'm the worst to talk. I don't leave my house. We'll be right back. let's talk about some of the pieces in the show and some of the aesthetics that you're going for. One thing you're talking about is that toy-esque imagery.
Yes. I don't know. The last few years, I kind of hooked up with a few people in the toy industry. So I took a chance. I've never painted 3D before. Last year was the first time I painted 3D. I kind of got hooked. It's kind of addicting. I mean, just having you see your work come to life. Recently, I just did a toy for Electronic Arts. It was for one of their their games. They had commissioned us to reproduce these characters in toy form. And I'm painting another toy around the corner here. I think that kind of bled. It's kind of that Japanese big-eyed children, you know, children like cute characters. It really bled into the show. I'm really into it right now. I can't explain it. And I'm getting a lot of positive response from it. You know, from a completely different crowd that I was dealing with in the past. I mean, I think in a lot of ways I kind of caught the wave of the whole cocktail culture thing in the mid '90s, and so I found myself painting a lot of cocktail oriented images, and now I'm going completely. We've gone from, you know, the lounge to jumping in a rocket and going to outer space. You know, now we're orbiting the universe. It's completely different now, and it's really helped energize all this new work, because I really feel like I'm kind of moving on mm-hmm. at this point.
Well, it's a different time.
Yeah. And it's giving me a chance to kind of mix the two as well, you know, where I can take geometrics and I can take figures and mix them up with textures, which I've never done before, and painting on wood, which was also kind of fun, actually. I never thought I'd like painting on wood, but I really like the fact that you can see the grain.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a while since I painted on wood, so it's kind of brought me back. It swung me around in a lot of different ways, because I've gone from all the way to my past, my roots, you know, where I painted a lot of submarines. I love submarines. And I've gone all the way to the cocktail girls and now the toys. And the show literally is a mix of almost everything I've ever painted in the last 15 years. Really.
It's kind of a mini retrospective.
It's a mini retrospective. You can get a taste of everything I've ever done in this show.
And it's all mini.
It's all mini. It's tiny. It's pocket size. You could take it home in a baggie. I have to say, you know, going from large, medium, and now small is by far the hardest. I never thought that a 6-inch piece would be so difficult. But
do you find that you have a certain idea of what you want in a painting, and so you're used to dealing with these large ones, and then, okay, well, I want to put this in this little one, and it'll just be smaller.
Well, originally I thought that it would be very modular, like you could take this piece and put it with this piece, and put it with this number, and put it with this figure. I thought maybe, you know, at first that would be the way to do it, but as it progressed, I realized that maybe it was just too conceptual, and that I really didn't.
Is it triptych? Is that the phrase?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know how many. You put 100 pieces together, what do you call that? I just like the fact that you could buy 6 bricks. You could buy 6 of these blocks and put them together, and you can mix and match, and pick. You know, it's perfect. They're almost like they should be one giant painting, but you could walk away with pieces of the painting, which is an idea. Kind of, it's still rolling around my head that maybe this could lead into something else, like doing larger walls of these images in more geometric form. I'm really more into geometrics right now. But
just, you mean like using square or using like different like triangles and L's?
A few years back, I saw a BC Binning show at the Bag, and
the Vancouver Gallery.
That's right, and it completely changed the way I looked at art. I never really looked at just integrating geometrics as an art. You know, it's a '60s concept, but I'd like to kind of take it and update it for the 21st century. You know,
yeah.
And make something new out of it. You know, which I've done in my in the past in my backgrounds, but I never brought them to the foreground. I don't think I've given the geometrics enough credit. You know, I always faded them into the background, but I really like to pull them out and just focus on geometrics.
Well, tell me about that 50s influence, because that is a big part of what you do. Is that, you know, when you're taking, I mean, we've talked a lot about Gene Deitch,
yeah,
as a big influence,
yeah,
and yeah, that aesthetic, and it's not, and that's kind of a mistake some people may make, is like thinking, like seeing that kind of abstractness and lumping it in with the cocktail stuff, but it is a separate kind of, like, I almost want to say, you know, post cartoony, like,
yeah, maybe,
like the Rocky and Bullwinkle.
I still find that a large group of my work is all based on cartoons that I watched when I was a kid. I was a huge Hanna-Barbera fan, and Gerald McBoing-Boing is probably one of my favorite cartoons ever. And if you take that and you mix it with the 50s and 60s advertising, which is probably my biggest influence. I mean, I think I get more ideas by flipping through old advertising than I would ever flipping through a comic book.
Mm-hmm.
Which is always been, and you know, children's books, well, that, from the 50s and 60s, I mean, I've always really liked really simplified graphics, you know, really heavy line, simplified graphics with bright colors.
Well, like a lot of the illustrators of that time would go in to do advertising. That was like the one thing
that's true.
And like comic artists would also do.
I know,
stuff
and
like
you,
that.
You look at their work and it's just so meticulous compared to advertising today, which seems so watered down and contrived. I mean, you look at these pieces and the lettering was drawn by hand, the characters were drawn by hand, everything was meticulous, and in a lot of ways I strive to be more like that, but I kind of wish I could do what a lot of those early illustrators did. I think actually illustration is probably my biggest influence. I think in a lot of ways that 50s advertising has definitely been the biggest influence on my artwork.
You were at the animation event I did last summer at the gallery.
Yes.
Did you see that weird TV advertising thing I threw in by the I think it was the studio that Deitch
runs? That's right. Was it API? Is it API?
No, I can't remember. I should know this. I should totally know this, and I don't. Because it was... I'm going to get flogged for not remembering. But it's stuff like that. It's quite interesting. Like, this, like, really incredible, almost surreal animation where it's just, like, these blocks of colors telling this, like, story of how great television is.
And that's where, you know, like I said, the Gerald and Boing-Boing thing comes into play. I mean, you look at those graphics, and just like a train, it's
Terry Toons.
Terry Toons. It's a train is not a train. It's a block of color, and it's, you know, it's just like a block with bubbles pouring out of it. And out of context, you wouldn't know it was a train, but you know, just by turning that into motion, you create like imagery, like surrealistic imagery out of colors, blocks of colors, and. I always loved that. I always thought somehow I need to do that. I need to somehow absorb that into my work. I've never been able to do it. Maybe the colors, but the shapes, I've never been able to pull that off.
Well, it's fascinating what you can do with telling stories with abstraction and using simple things to mean different things and stuff. I find that really...
I think that's what my paintings lack is narrative. Like, they don't really tell stories. They're eye candy. I mean,
that's
literally
okay.
They're eye candy, and I think that's okay too. I mean, not everything has to tell a story. You know,
do you feel you need to tell a story?
Well, sometimes only if it's very, you know. It's sometimes dreams will tell you a story, but I find for the most part I'm more into icons, and you know, scooters.
Yes, you are a Vespa man.
Yes, and this will probably be the last Vespa I paint. And the Vespa I'm painting in the show, I've kind of run that towel.
It's
I don't
the death
think
Vespa.
I can paint any more scooters. I think that's it.
What attracted you to the scooter, to the Vespa?
Well, the Vespa's, you know, originally when I moved to Vancouver, I had never seen a Vespa before, and I'd be wandering around town, and I'd see, like, giant gangs of these scooters buzzing by, and they're all different colors, and they made this poppy sound. It's just damn cool, and it literally, like, I've said this in the past, they're pop art on two wheels, and I just knew I had to have a scooter.
Is that clean?
It's that
atomic
retro, yeah,
rareness.
Very rocket-like imagery, and in a lot of ways, I still feel that when I'm driving my bike around town. I still feel like this is like driving a painting. It's like driving art, and I'm still attracted to that. I still flip through websites and I just need another scooter. I need it in this color, or I need it in that color, or I need it in this style. But it, you know, it's always been a fun thing. I can't say that it's ever been anything serious. It's been more of a personal passion, and it's worked its way into my artwork. I mean, there's a lot of mod imagery in my paintings, and
you have a use of subtle use of numbers in some pieces, and you're showing me some of the other bigger pieces. And numerical play.
I'm obsessed with numbers. I've always integrated them into the paintings in a lot of ways. Originally, I actually wanted to be an astronomer. I think that's what I wanted. And I was obsessed with, you know, calculations and numbers and, I don't know why. I mean, maybe it's my love of photography. I really love fonts and I really like characters. And every opportunity I get, I stick a number in, you know, and they don't really mean anything, you know, they just... But, you know, numbers can mean a lot as well, you know. It's like a subconscious thing. You know? Everybody can attach a memory or a feeling towards a number, you know.
And I was looking, like, when we're going through the piece, like, oh, look, a 23 one.
23, a magic number. It's a magic number. And, I actually already had a few requests to integrate numbers that people wanted to see in the canvases. So I did a couple of custom numbers as well for the show. And I don't know, it kind of lends itself to the characters, you know, like replacing an eye with a number I just love it.
It's a different aesthetic.
It is a different aesthetic. It makes you think. And, you know, people may read into these pieces a little more than they should, because really, in the end, like I said, I'm a purveyor of eye candy, you know. I really just like... I'm more into it for the color and the shapes than I am telling a story, and that's just the way it is with me.
And that's okay.
That's okay.
That's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
I hear the opposite all the time, so.
You know, what's funny is there are comics I'll read where it'll be obvious that the person just wanted to draw certain things. You don't need to make, you know, just... You didn't need to make a comic around it.
Just draw. I think the comic that... I read the most when I was a kid in the 70s, Plop magazine, and it was probably the weirdest magazine I could find. And I read obviously Mad and Cracked and everything else as a kid, but Plop magazine was like...
Plop was odd because it had like so much Basil Wharton.
That's right, and it was all about for me it was all about the covers. The covers always had the really mutated characters, like the guy with the testicles hanging out of his mouth, or the creature smoking a pipe that is his nose, and that stuff really appealed to me when I was...
Can you imagine them releasing that now?
Oh, I know. I can't even imagine Pop Magazine being in a comic store. It's just I've actually been really disillusioned with comics lately. I find that I've kind of pulled away from comic stores and maybe I'm leaning more towards, like I said, advertising. I find more interest in more retro imagery than I do actual comic book stories. Looking at my work too, I can see that I'm not really telling much of a story. So,
well, your day gig is commercial illustration.
Yeah, I'm a graphic designer at the Jordan Strait magazine.
Vancouver's notorious alt weekly.
That's right.
Formerly notorious, pretty mainstream.
Yeah, it is a little bit. You know, it's kind of a funny place to work because, most of the people there, you know, we've all been there 15 or so years together, so like we're like a big family. And in a lot of ways, the paper's kind of grown as we've grown. And, there's a lot of good people at the Georgia Strait. Mm-hmm. You know, there's still a lot of good at the Georgia Strait. I know a lot of people put it down, but I think that...
It's better than the center of the province.
You know, you go to a lot of cities and you see a lot of alt weeklies and they don't even compare to the Georgia Strait. You know, in a lot of ways, you know, maybe it's not how I would envision a paper, but it's still a really half-decent place to work, I have to say. For a full-time job, it's been a really great environment.
Now, you were telling me earlier before we were recording how some of the images you've worked out kind of in your, like, spot illustrations and stuff. How does that work for you as far as, like...
Spot illustrations in the magazine? Well, yeah, I mean, for 12 years now, I've been drawing the health column through the story, which is kind of funny because I've never really had much of an interest in health-related articles, but I found that it really did pull a lot of... It really did force me to draw things that I would have never drawn. Like, how do you draw syphilis? I mean, how do you make syphilis into a happy character?
You draw Victoria the Prince.
I've done all sorts of strange topics, like curing hysteria, all sorts of viruses and all sorts of, illnesses. It really bums you out. But, I try my best to make those characters as happy and bubbly as possible. But you know what? I'm really glad that, though my illustration gig at the Strait has kind of come to an end, I'm really glad that I've had that much time to exercise my drawing skills, because freelance illustration kind of always will force you to expand your horizons and try new things. I'll never discount that. I always think that's probably the biggest education I've ever had.
It's forcing you to do something that you wouldn't normally
do.
Why would I draw the human personification of syphilis?
Exactly. And you know what? There are a lot of characters from those columns that made their way into the show. Just stuff I never thought I would ever paint. And I just thought I'd push it a little further and see if I could actually bring them to life and put them in a gallery, which is interesting. Because, you don't see a lot of illustration in galleries. Mm-hmm. I think that's always been one of my biggest beefs. And that's one of the reasons why my wife and I opened the Moonbase Gallery in 96. We really wanted to showcase a lot of Vancouver's illustrators. It kind of got pushed and pulled in a lot of different ways, but in the end, we managed to show some of our favorite illustrators, like Tom Bagley and Rod Philbrand.
Rod's fantastic.
Yeah, I love Rod's work. And it was a fun experience. You don't see a lot, even when you go to Chicago or L.A., you still don't see a lot of that work. Maybe more L.A. than Chicago, but...
It's so odd that the notion illustrator is such a separate thing, but it is.
It is. It
because,
be.
Like, I did a show last year of comic artists.
Yeah. Of comic art.
And it was definitely given a different treatment by the gallery, I'm sure, than the previous show of someone drawing on planks of wood. Painting on planks. Not that I'm saying you're painting on planks.
No. I totally agree. I mean, there's a fine line between somebody would title themselves as painter or illustrator or artist or cartoonist. I don't see any barriers between them. I don't see the difference between an illustrated drawing and an oil painting. I don't see the difference. I don't understand why, you know, galleries like the Vancouver Art Gallery sometimes will put barriers up.
The Vancouver Art Gallery has no clue. I'm going to be honest. They have no fucking clue. Like, after that crazy show, I'm sorry, like, I had so many issues with their whole comic section. It's like, no, stop my tangent there.
Yeah, I was really disappointed with that show. I thought that, though, you know, Spiegelman put together a good compilation of work that he was inspired by.
But that's Spiegelman.
I thought they could do so much more and showcase so much more art in Vancouver that... And that show would have been perfect. It would have been the perfect venue to actually pull a lot of pop artists and cartoonists and just like underground artists that strive to make any sort of living in this city. And it's almost like we're invisible. Like they don't want to see us. Like they swept us under the carpet. Yet we can take our work to LA or Chicago or New York or Toronto, and we can thrive there. You know, that's my biggest problem right now is that I cannot find a venue in Vancouver to show my work. I'm constantly taking my work to the U.S., which is, I love the U.S. Americans have a really, really bold approach to art. I mean, they're not afraid of the barriers, and mm-hmm. they're okay with doing new work and showcasing new artists. And in a lot of ways, you know, I catch that vibe in Chicago because it's just thriving.
There's so many great,
I know,
as far as like cartoonists, like there's so many that stay in Chicago. And
yeah, it's true. And there's just so much going on there. And everybody seems, you know, they're not quite as organized as some cities. Like I find LA would be a little more organized, but there's a community. And I find that Vancouver is lacking a bit of a community, an arts community. You know, even a cartoonist community. I mean, we all get together maybe once a year, you know, we'll meet up with people, we'll see people in the streets, but rarely will you ever bring people together for some gala, giant get-together, meet-up, you know, where we can all mix our art together and talk about that. It just doesn't seem to be happening in Vancouver. It's been my greatest disappointment about the city. I mean, there have been attempts. I mean, there's always been galleries, you know, in the past, I was always a big fan of a Walk Is Gallery on Denman Street, and a Smash Gallery when I first made in Vancouver. That Smash Gallery really inspired my work. And
who were some artists when you moved to Vancouver that really?
Well, you know, when I first moved to Vancouver, I kind of got taken in by Jim Cummings, who was more than willing to kind of help out this new kid in town, and he kind of took me in his studio, and he let me play with his stuff, and he let me play with his silk screens, and he let me, you know, take my work to his house and mold sculptures on the floor. By far, Jim Cummings, aka Brain Eater, was probably my biggest influence as far as the Vancouver art scene goes. I really, I really love Jim. I think, you know, he really has. I think in a lot of ways he has personified, you know, pop art in Vancouver. He really has inspired a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of even kids I meet today in the street, fresh out of art school, they still talk about Jim Cummings, which is cool. I don't think Jim gets the credit that he deserves.
No, he's got a lot of respect, but a lot of people kind of discount him as like a post-industrial relic.
I know,
it's
true.
In the same vein as, say, like, the Skinny Puppy album.
Yeah, I know. And, you know,
it's unfortunate because it's not, like, they're different entities.
And I always loved those album covers. And actually, there was a lot of the artwork of Network Records in the 80s that kind of drew me to the city because I could see that there was this huge... There was something going on here, you know, and there's something that wasn't going on in Winnipeg at the time. You know, I could see that there was music and art, and you know, the city was growing, and it was at the time it was still cheap to live in, and you know, and you know, we could all, you know, we even in the mid 90s, you know, my wife Jody and I opened up a gallery. You know, we had a gallery, we had a studio, you know, we could afford to live above the gallery. You know, we could do it all. And still afford to eat. And now, you know, we're looking at the you know, the late 2000s, and God, we can't afford
the
a studio.
Aughts.
I'm painting in a closet, you know, and, and what happened?
It's like you're in New York.
What happened? Yeah, I know, but in New York, I mean, there's still outlets, you know, whereas I find Vancouver, a lot of the outlets are shutting down because a lot of people can't afford to open new galleries, mm-hmm. and the galleries are getting smaller and they're getting more temporary, and they're just not as visible as they were in the past. I think that Vancouver is losing out big time by trying to sell us into this high-end, high-market city, and all of the artists and the creatives are being basically tossed by the wayside. I think it's a tragedy, actually, that so many people have to leave town to build their art. And the art is already here. The artists are here. They just need a place to showcase their work.
Vancouver's like an aesthetic city.
It is a beautiful city. And it's a beautiful city. You know, I can't say it's all terrible and that everybody here is terrible, because I mean, I'm obviously here for that very same reason that everybody else is. But I think really the city somehow needs to put space aside. And, you know, say that this area is for artists only, and rent is not going to be outrageous, you know. It's, there will be galleries, and there will be noise, and there will be crazy art.
And that's okay,
you know. Not everything has to be hermetically sealed. I find that the things are very sterilized now.
Well, areas that used to be predominantly artist-based are being quickly transformed into some kind of, like,
gas
future athletic.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Gastown used to be, you know, an artist-rich neighborhood. And Strathcona, for that matter. I find that even Strathcona is bleeding artists by the gallon. I mean, where are these people going? If they're not leaving town, like, I always wonder, where is this going, you know? Are we really going to lose all of our artists for the sake of real estate?
Yep. The doom and gloom of...
Hey, it happens in every city. I mean, Seattle had the same problem quite a few years ago when Belltown started turning into a condo district, and the artists basically picked up their bags and moved to the airport. I mean, there's now a thriving...
Georgetown, I've been there. It's incredible.
Artist community. And, you know, how long will it be before the developers look at that and go, well, that's where we need new condos.
It's really... It's in the middle of nowhere.
Exactly. I mean, we need to find a desolate area in Vancouver where we can also...
We don't have that. We have it's so... Could everything... There's hills surrounding us in Surrey.
That's right. We're running out of artist-friendly space.
Maybe we should just take up a part of Stanley Park. not us as being a part of it anymore.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm an outside voice. Well, thank you for taking the time to sit and chat with me, Mark.
Thanks, Robin.
I'm very happy to check out your work, and I hope your show in Chicago does quite nicely.
Thanks very much.
And listeners into Chicago, go and check it out.
Yes. RotaFuji.com.
And I'll have all the links posted on the website, inkstance.com. Thanks for listening.
My baby's gone on a trip to the moon, and she won't be back too soon. She doesn't write me and I can't sleep. All I hear from her is, my baby's up in a rocket machine. Since she left, she ain't been seen. She doesn't call me and I can't sleep. All I hear from her is, I wonder if means I miss you, or maybe means I want to kiss you. I'm hoping that means I love you and she's coming down to earth again. My baby's high in the stratosphere. I'm so low cause I'm down here. My love for her is gonna keep till she comes back and whispers. I'm hoping that means I love you and she's coming down to earth again. My baby's fooling around with a satellite. Now you know that that ain't right. My love for her is gonna keep till she comes back and whispers. My baby's fooling around with some space cat. That chick don't know where she's at. She better come on down here to earth and groove. I ain't gonna move. I'll lay that sound on me.